I'm going to talk about the dynamical approach to relativity, Harvey Brown's view about how we should understand the geometry of relativity theory. And I think it turns out that this topic is an ideal case study for a lot of the things that have been discussed so far, more so than I expected to be the case. So let me start with two slogans. Rods and clocks do what they do because space-time's geometry is what it is. Or is it the case that the geometry of space-time is what it is because rods and clocks do what they do? And you'll notice that in these slogans there's this key word, because. And how we should think of that because in these two slogans, I think, is not entirely straightforward. Roughly speaking, I think in the first slogan, the because is something like a causal explanation, because. And in the second one, it's something like a metaphysical or perhaps a logical explanation, because. But we will see the details. But that's, I think, one interesting set of questions to consider in light of what we've heard so far. Anyway, the view to be defended is that rods and clocks do what they do because space-time's geometry is what it is. So let me say a bit more about the two views that these slogans are meant to encapsulate. So the first one is what Harvey calls the geometrical approach. And according to the geometrical approach, the geometry of space-time, being what it is, in part, not completely, but in part explains why, amongst other things, rods and clocks do what they do. It's completely compatible with thinking that the geometry of space-time is not itself fundamental, but it's certainly not the case, unless you're going to be caught in some vicious explanatory circularity, that it's not fundamental and grounded in the behaviour of rods and clocks, or in the symmetries of the dynamical theories in terms of which the behaviour of familiar rods and clocks might otherwise be modelled and explained. So that's the geometrical approach. Contrast that with the dynamical approach, and I won't say much about it now. We will. Part of the purpose of this talk is to push a bit further than is sometimes pushed, what that might actually commit you to. But the key commitment is that the geometry of space-time is what it is in virtue of the behaviour of rods and clocks. So here's a quotation from Harvey Brown. "The Minkowski metric is no more than the codification of the behaviour of rods and clocks. Or equivalently, it is no more than the Kleinian geometry associated with the symmetry group of the quantum physics of the non-gravitational interactions in the theory of matter." Okay, so the structure of what I'm going to say has four parts. I'm going to start, perhaps by taking a bit too long, covering common ground. And I take this common ground to be a whole bunch of commitments that Harvey has pressed that we should accept. But they're commitments that the substantivalist, or the advocate of the geometrical approach, should have no problem accepting too. So it's important to cover those, to clear them away and not get distracted by thinking that's where the action is. And then we'll move on to looking in turn at these key explanatory claims. The first, that space-time symmetries in the geometry of space-time can explain the behaviour of rods and clocks, in particular by explaining dynamical symmetries. And we'll see why that's the thing to look at after we've covered the common ground. Then we'll turn to what the dynamical approach advocate wants to say, that you can explain geometry in terms of dynamical symmetries. And finally, I will probably not have any time, but I've got one slide on the status of the metric in general relativity. Okay, so the common ground. Here are the four things that I think will not distinguish between someone who believes in the dynamical approach and, I'll keep saying substantivalist, but I mean an advocate of the geometrical approach. So the first claim is that the principle of principle theories are not explanatory. I had originally intended to say principle theories are not explanatory, but I became aware that exactly what you mean by a principle theory is ambiguous. So the safe thing to say is that the principles of principle theories are not explanatory. Everyone should recognise that explanation is context-dependent and in that sense pluralistic. And then we get on to particular explanations of characteristically relativistic phenomena, and in particular explaining why, for example, a rod contracts when set into motion. And everyone should concede that explaining why a material rod of some specific type exhibits characteristically relativistic behaviour need not, and in some sense should not, appeal to the details of the dynamics. So the advocate of the dynamical approach is not saying that you have to appeal to the dynamical details of the dynamics of the rod to explain its contraction. But if you want to explain why such a rod functions as a rod in the first place, you will have to say something about the details of its dynamics. And in particular, the advocate of the geometrical approach certainly shouldn't disagree with that. So we're going to quickly review why all of those things are true. So let me start by reminding you, because I think most of you will be very familiar with this, that the distinction between principle theories and constructive theories, and just to point out the sense in which the principles of principle theories are not themselves explanatory. So according to Einstein, principle theories involve starting or finding certain regularities in the phenomena from which you can go on to derive, and then this is a direct quote from his 1919 Times article, a theory which will apply in every case. So the idea is that wherever these regularities in the phenomena hold, the thing that you can derive via the principle theory approach is guaranteed to hold and be true as well. And when you apply this to Einstein's 1905 derivation of the Lorentz transformations, of course, everyone's familiar that the principles he has in mind as the regularities in the phenomena on which everything rests are, in addition to the isotropy of space and the homogeneity of space and time, the relativity principle and the light postulate. And then the question is, what is the best way of conceiving of the theory which will apply in every case from that is derived from those principles? And although it may not have been exactly how Einstein originally would have presented it, I think now the best thing to say is that what one derives, the result of Einstein's 1905 derivation, is that all the fundamental laws are Lorentz covariant. So it's tempting to think that Einstein has this kind of shift of view between his 1905 position and later on when he says, here's what special relativity about. It's the Lorentz invariance of the fundamental laws. There's a sense in which, as he presents it, that's true, but there's a sense in which materially that doesn't represent a shift at all, because the Lorentz invariance of the laws is just the main conclusion of the 1905 derivation. Okay. And then contrast that with constructive theories, where in a constructive theory, one builds a picture of complex phenomena out of some relatively simple postulates. And Einstein went on to say that it's really constructive theories that provide you with the understanding of the phenomena in question. And of course, this is where you might mistakenly think that you need to provide a constructive theory in this sense of length contraction if you're really to understand it. And I'm going to claim that that's not the case, and that Harvey would agree, or at least we've said things that mean that in the past. Okay, so why should we say that the principles of principle theories are non-explanatory? So let's consider length contraction, and here's the slide that Minkowski used in his 1908 lecture, and this is a very familiar story. So we're considering two rods, the red rod and the green rod, in relative motion, and we're noticing that according to Minkowski geometry, the length QQ is shorter than PP. And that follows if Q prime Q prime is the same as PP, according to Minkowski geometry, which is just to say these are two rods that are otherwise identical, except for their relative motion. And let's think about this from the perspective of deriving that this is how things look from the Lorentz transformations, having derived those from Einstein's principles. And in the context of thinking about relativity as a principle theory, you might ask, well, what explains what? And in particular, I suggest it would be clearly a mistake to think that the principles from which you derive something in the 1905 derivation are explanatory of what you go on to derive, in particular length contraction. To say they were would be to say that the relativity principle, this phenomenological fact that you can't do an experiment to detect your state of motion, and the phenomenological fact that whenever you measure the speed of light, you find that it's independent of the speed of the source, that those facts explain why rods contract. Surely, if anything, it's the other way around. It's the fact that rods contract that allows you to measure this fact about light in one frame and the very same fact in a frame that's moving uniformly with respect to the first frame. However, if you go on to what was derived from the principles, namely the Lorentz covariance of the laws, it does seem that you can appeal to those to explain certain facts about length contraction. Okay. So, on to the contextual nature of explanation. I'm going to pass over that comment. So here's a quote from Yuri Balashov and Michelle Janssen about what it takes to explain length contraction. Length contraction is explained by showing that two observers who are otherwise who are in relative motion use different sets of space-time axes as a result, and therefore disagree about which cross-sections of a world tube of a physical system give the length of a system. And this is really just Minkowski's explanation. So we have, take the green rod, someone at rest with the green rod is using Q prime as its cross-section, someone at rest with respect to the red rod and using that system of coordinates is going to take QQ to be the length of the rod, and they are different lengths in Minkowski geometry, and therefore they conclude that it's a different length. Now, the advocate of the dynamical approach says, of course, this is a perfectly fine explanation. So no one thinks that you can't appeal to Minkowski geometry to explain things. But of course, in doing that, to explain things about certain physical systems, you're assuming, you're just taking it for granted that those material systems conform to and obey and exhibit and manifest Minkowski geometry. And you might ask, well, what explains that? How come these material systems do that? And going back to Einstein's thought that to understand a phenomenon, we've got to come up with a constructive theory of it, you might be tempted to go down the following route, right? You might think that what you need to do is provide some kind of Bell-style constructive derivation in terms of the detailed dynamics of the particular system you're considering of its behavior with respect to a single frame of reference. So here's what we said in a paper a while ago. The truly constructive explanation of length contraction involves solving the dynamics governing the structure of the complex material body that undergoes contraction. Now, I'm putting these up because I stand by most of it, and I stand by this. If you want to explain length contraction constructively, i.e. provide a constructive theory, this is what you will end up doing. And we, in this passage, also concede, of course, that there are lots of contexts in which you might want to do something other than that. But let's just think about what... Well, let's just consider whether this derivation, so we're considering as Bell does, or imagining in principle that you do what Bell gestures at, that you could, given the equations, the exact equations that describe your system, derive that it behaves in a particular way and in particular length contracts when you boost it in a particular way. So I would claim that such an explanation, such a derivation is genuinely explanatory. It's a canonical example of the kind of thing that's done in physics all the time to explain stuff in a constructive context. However, this isn't to concede something that goes against the geometrical approach, because according to someone who thinks that fundamentally geometrical structure is not to be derived in terms of dynamical symmetries, that it's some primitive part of the structure of the world, this kind of story, the Bell-type story, is appealing implicitly to geometrical structure. So I'll leave it as an exercise for you to think through how that works in the case of something like Bell's story about length contraction, but just consider Newton's bucket. And the way in which inertial structure figures in a causal explanation of why the water becomes concave when the bucket's spinning. So it's not the fact that somehow there's a mysterious law, and Nick Huggett makes this point nicely, that when things spin, there's some inertial force that pushes the water up the sides. No, we've got the standard physical story about why the water becomes concave if the bucket's spinning, in terms of if it's spinning, all the parts of the... If it's absolutely spinning, something that we can... Well, that according to the advocate of the geometrical approach, we understand in primitive, in terms of primitive inertial structure, if it's spinning, there must be net accelerative forces towards the centre of the bucket. And to get those, you need the right kind of pressure gradient. And the equilibrium configuration will involve the concave surface. So to be sympathetic to the advocate of the geometrical approach, you have to think through that the standard kind of story, typically given in standard inertial coordinates, and recognize all the places where, if you were an advocate of the geometrical approach, geometrical facts, or facts that are defined in terms of geometrical structure, are featuring in your constructive explanation. Okay, final comment on this. Of course, this explanation in some sense is not very good. Because when I have given this complex derivation in terms of, say, electromagnetism of my particular system, that it will Lorentz contract, I haven't given myself any reason to think that another body will Lorentz contract in exactly the same way, even if it's also described by the very same laws, because maybe it involves a different sort of equilibrium configuration of different of a different state of material. And of course, Lorentz contraction is a universal phenomenon. So this kind of explanation, although I think it is genuinely explanatory, is missing something big out. And here's where this point is made. So in many contexts, perhaps in most contexts, one should not appeal to the details of the dynamics governing the microstructure of bodies when one is giving explanations of them. And here, it isn't right to call these explanations constructive explanations. So the basic point made in this passage is, assume that there are stable bodies. Assume that there are bodies that function like rods. It is the fact that the laws governing their constitution, whatever they are, a Lorentz covariant, that explains why they contract. So it's the Lorentz invariance of the laws that explains why they contract, and we'll see in a moment exactly how that explanation goes. It would be a mistake to think that you actually have to appeal to the dynamical details if you're in the business of explaining Lorentz contraction as a universal phenomenon. Okay. And these aren't constructive explanations. One might be tempted to deny that an explanation that appeals to symmetries are constructive explanations. In other words, there are even fewer contexts than one might have first supposed in which length contraction stands in need of a constructive theory explanation. Okay, so I say that this is common ground between the advocate of the dynamical approach, and then you saw several quotes from co-authored by Harvey, advocate of the dynamical approach. Here's someone who seems to think exactly the same thing, and this anonymous illustration will not be anonymous to most of you, because several of you have heard me go through this before, but this is just an illustration of the things that I've just gone through. So this author starts by noting that an appropriately accelerated rod undergoes a sort of real physical contraction and concedes that this is caused by the intraatomic forces binding the rod together. Why does this happen? The author says we could explain this by giving a Bell-style derivation in terms of the details of this object's dynamics, but we can give a general argument. And the key to giving this general argument lies in the notion of a rigid body, where by a rigid body we just mean a body that has an equilibrium configuration that is pretty stable under the relevant perturbations that we're considering. Absent a detailed account of this object's dynamics, from the fact that our theory of it is a specially relativistic theory and that it's a rigid body in this sense, we can derive that it will Lorentz contract. So here's how that story goes, according to this author. So suppose a system has an equilibrium state that it tends to maintain when it is free of external forces. And let's call this state SEQ. In a given Lorentz coordinate system, such as the rest frame of the system, SEQ has some particular coordinate dependent description. Now consider a different physical state. At this point, we're not even assuming that it's physically possible. It's just a different kinematically possible state for this object that's defined as follows. This other state has a description in a Lorentz boosted coordinate system, which is exactly the same description that SEQ has in our original coordinate system. So this kind of thinking is very close to Lorentz's, the way Lorentz was thinking about things when he was deriving his theorem of corresponding states. Now, it follows, if our laws are relativistic, that this state S prime will in fact be a physical state, and moreover, it will be an equilibrium state. And how the body behaves with respect to this state, in with respect to the coordinate system in which it has a description just like SEQ, will be just like how the body behaves with respect to the state SEQ as described in the original coordinate system. So, reading the last line, the behavior of S prime described in terms of the new Lorentz coordinates will be identical to the behavior of SEQ described in terms of the old coordinates. So, if initially the system is disposed to return to SEQ after the appropriate physical boost, it will be disposed to return to S prime. We do not even need to know the details of the forces that bind the system together. So just to quickly recap, we have this state SEQ, an equilibrium state, and we're considering a particular coordinate system K in which it gets a particular description. We then consider K prime, a Lorentz boosted coordinate system, and a different state S prime, which is defined as a state that whose description with respect to K prime is exactly the same as SEQ's description with respect to K. And the key claim was, if the fundamental laws are relativistic, S prime will be an equilibrium state, and if you perturb the system in the right kind of way, it will end up in the state S prime, and because it's exactly like SEQ, but described with respect to a Lorentz-boosted coordinate system, that's a Lorentz-contracted state. Okay. So. So, if the fundamental laws are relativistic, i.e. if they're Lorentz invariant. So, this advocate of the dynamical approach, I think many of you will know, is none other than Tim Maudlin, who you might think is one of the clearest proponents of the geometrical approach. So, what's going on? Well, I've said that all of these claims should never have been controversial to either side. Of course, there's more to the story, and this now gets us to the second part of the talk, the space-time explanation of dynamical symmetries. So here was the key omission from the quotations from Tim Maudlin I was giving. When I said, if the fundamental laws are relativistic, we have a story that Harvey would be presumably completely happy to embrace if we read that as the claim that the laws are Lorentz invariant. That's not quite how Tim Maudlin puts it. So here's his statement. Here's what it is for a law to be relativistic. The fundamental requirement of a relativistic theory is that the physical law should be specifiable using only the relativistic space-time geometry. For special relativity in particular, this means Minkowski space-time. And having said this, in the quotation I gave you, he goes on to say, here's why it follows from that, that this claim about S prime and SEQ with respect to the coordinates K and K prime, which are related by Lorentz transformations, here's why that's true. The laws of physics take exactly the same coordinate-based form when stated in coordinate-based language in a Lorentz coordinate system because, and then we're just repeating the fundamental requirement, that Minkowski geometry, well, the second claim here, the laws can only avert to Minkowski geometry, which is just to say there are no other fixed structures that you might use to define and express your laws other than Minkowski geometry. And then, of course, the Lorentz coordinate systems just are the coordinate systems in which Minkowski geometry takes a particular, particularly simple force, form. The distance relations of Minkowski geometry are encoded in the coordinate system in just the way that Euclidean distances are encoded in Cartesian coordinates. Okay, so what he's saying here is that the symmetries of space-time explain the symmetries of the laws. If by the symmetries of the laws you think in the special coordinate systems, the symmetries of the laws are just the transformations between coordinate systems in which the laws take an especially simple form. Okay, so this commitment that the symmetries of space-time explain the symmetries of the laws is expressed by Balashov and Janssen in this quote. They put the choice to us. Does Minkowski space-time explain why the forces holding a rod together are Lorentz invariant or the other way around? Our intuition is that the geometrical structure of space-time is the exponans here and the invariance of the force, the exponandum. Now, they don't say any more, and they appeal to intuition, which is perhaps unfortunate, but we've just seen that there is much more you can say. So, can we make sense of the claim that dynamical symmetries are what they are because the symmetries of space-time are what they are? Here's Harvey Brown's reaction to this general claim. It is the heart of the matter, he says, but it's wholly unclear how this geometrical explanation is supposed to work. Well, I take it that the story we've looked at already a bit in the Morden quote gives us an indication of how it is supposed to work, but I'll talk a little bit more about it, but before I do, let me just give you some other quotations where this intuition that appeal to space-time structure as explanatory is getting the cart before the horse, in particular about inertial structure. So here's Harvey again on force-free motion. Force-free bodies conspire to move in straight lines at uniform speeds while being unable, by fiat, to communicate with each other. It is probably fair to say that anyone who is not amazed by this conspiracy has not understood it. So, there's something that you might want to try and explain. You might think that you can explain it by postulating inertial structure and then saying that it's a law-like feature of the world that bodies not under the action of forces, their motion has to be adapted to that inertial structure in the right kind of way. But Harvey's reaction is to appeal to the action of background space-time or a background space-time connection in which the particles are immersed is arguably to enhance the mystery, not to remove it. Why? Because there's no dynamical coupling of the connection with matter in the usual sense of the term. Now, it's certainly true that if we were thinking that the explanation has to go via some kind of action of space-time on the force-free bodies, then that's not something we're familiar with from physics. But I take it that's not how the explanation goes. So Harvey's conclusion is simply more natural, better philosophy to consider absolute space-time structure as the codification of certain brute, miraculous regularities in the behaviour of force-free bodies. Okay, well, let's just stick with pre-relativistic physics. Some nice plots from Julian Barber's book of three bodies moving under the action of gravitation. And here we see what work inertial structure is doing in Newtonian theory, standardly understood. All of these plots involve initial configurations that, with respect to the relative distances and the relative rates of change, the rates of change of those relative distances are identical. So in terms of what you might think the relational initial data should be, they're the very same initial state. And yet you see that they evolve and can evolve in all of these very different ways. Now, the Newtonian has a very neat, elegant explanation of that. In addition to the space-time structure carried by the material bodies themselves, the relative distances, and the temporal separations between instantaneous configurations, there is additional structure in the world, namely inertial structure, and it's in terms of that structure that Newton's laws appear to be formulated, right? We have a simple force law, only dependent on the relative separation of the bodies, but what the forces determine is the accelerations of the bodies. And prima facie, to understand what that means, we need inertial structure. And just by helping ourselves to that very simple, elegant extra bit of structure, we've got a very elegant, simple explanation of all these very complicated differences between these cases. And that's the explanatory work that inertial structure is doing for you. Just taking this at face value, inertial structure is playing an explanatory role in explaining the differences between these relationally identical, initially, configurations. Okay, so let's go back to the explanation of Lorentz invariance in terms of Minkowski geometry. So according to David Wallace in a recent paper, the explanatory story I'm about to run through is the consensus view in foundational work on how the coordinate-based approach to representing physical theories is to be understood. So Wallace's paper is concerned to defend the legitimacy and, for certain conceptual purposes, the preferability of presenting theories in coordinate-based terms with respect to special coordinates, rather than thinking everything has to be shoehorned into the straitjacket of differential geometry. But here's how the story goes. We first suppose that we've got some fixed structure, and we identify space-time symmetries as just those maps from space-time to itself that leave that structure invariant. Now, one typically thinks that differential structure is part of space-time structure, and it's absolute structure. So, of course, these transformations will be diffeomorphisms, but we're considering the subgroup which leaves other richer structure, like Minkowski distances invariant. Now, if the equations defining our theory are expressed with respect to coordinate systems related by an element of that symmetry group, then the numerical values of the components of the objects describing space-time structure will take the same value in each coordinate system. That's true whatever the coordinates. We can pick an arbitrary coordinate system and then consider another coordinate system related to it by such a symmetry. However, it may be that our space-time structure is very symmetric. There may be certain coordinate systems in which these components take very simple values. In particular, in the Minkowski space-time case, we can make only the diagonal elements, all but the diagonal elements vanish, and choose our coordinates so that they're either one, plus or minus one. Now, in those coordinates, our equations apparently simplify. And we have the standard form, the standard coordinate-based way of writing the theory. And Wallace's way of putting it is the standard coordinate-based way of writing a theory is to be understood simply as the differential geometric theory, but described with respect to the simple coordinate systems. So here I take it, is the geometrical advocate's explanation in terms of the symmetries of space-time structure, of why certain coordinate systems are preferred, and why the form of the equations with respect to those coordinates will be invariant with respect to exactly the space-time symmetry group. Okay. Assessing the explanation. So let's, for the sake of argument, grant the advocate of the geometrical approach that there is in the world this structure that's not to be defined in terms of or reduced to dynamical symmetries somehow otherwise understood. And let's suppose also that the laws are to be understood as certain relations that hold between the dynamical stuff in the world and that structure. That structure is being used to constrain what the dynamical possibilities are. Right? If you grant that, then what we've just seen is that it follows ineluctably that if that structure has certain symmetries, that if there are coordinates which make it look simple, then our coordinate expression of the laws, so understood, will look simple in those coordinates. And those coordinates will be related exactly by the space-time symmetries. So in that sense, I take it, we have an explanation. It's completely compatible with this way of deriving dynamical symmetries so understood, that the dynamical symmetry group might in fact be a proper supergroup of the group of transformations that preserve space-time structure. Just if our laws only use intuitively some but not all of the structure we've postulated. But if that's so, we're motivated to try and reformulate the laws in a way that doesn't involve postulating more structure than we really need. And this is what Erman calls symmetry principle SP1. Okay, now, I'm not sure advocates of the dynamical approach engage with the explanatory story just told directly, but they have various examples which are meant to give trouble for the general idea that you can explain dynamical symmetries in terms of postulated structure that has certain symmetries. So here are three that illustrate different kinds of problems. So Jacobson-Mattingly theory is a theory that looks a bit like electromagnetism in a dynamical Lorentzian space-time, but there's an extra constraint which forces the vector field to be time-like. Now, if I've got an object that's time-like, and given that I'm in the context of a dynamical geometry, so I'm only going to have locally preferred coordinate systems, it may be, given the nature of the dynamical object involved, that there are yet more, even more special coordinates. Right? If I've got a time-like vector field, at a point I can always choose a coordinate system that has that vector field as 1, 0, 0, 0. Okay? But that's completely compatible with the story we've just told. Okay? We could imagine a theory like this with fixed Minkowski background, but a vector field that's constrained to be time-like, but is dynamical. What we would then have is certain global coordinates, which are special, and which things look simple, just the standard Lorentz charts, but at any point we could always choose a special coordinate system from amongst that set that made things look even more special by adopting our time unit and time axis to the value of A mu nu at that point. Tevez. Here is a theory where we've got a primordial metric and another metric, and another field, and given the primordial metric and the other field, we can define an effective metric. And the theory tells us that it's the way in which normal matter couples, let's just say normal matter couples to the effective metric, just like it couples to the primordial metric in general relativity. If that's the case, then coordinate systems picked out in the way we've just described by the non-primordial metric will be special. But notice that the story about why those coordinate systems are special is just the standard one that the substantivalist or the advocate of the geometrical approach is giving. We've got some structure. It may be fundamental, it may not be. Is that 10 minutes? Okay, so the key thing to focus on is that the kind of mathematical logical story that we gave about the special coordinate systems has various variations that you can think through in these theories, but they're not counterexamples to the basic idea. They're just showing you that, you know, things can be interestingly more varied, but I don't take them to be counterexamples to the basic idea. And in particular, if we're not in these contexts, if we're in the nice, simple context of flat Minkowski space-time, then things work out as the advocate of the geometrical approach says. Okay, so in the last 10 minutes, let's consider, well, what if we try and reverse the order of explanatory priority and take dynamical symmetries as explaining space-time geometry? So let's go back to the quotation we had earlier. The Minkowskian metric is no more than the Kleinian geometry associated with the symmetry group of the quantum physics of the non-gravitational interactions in the theory of matter. Well, for that to be a way of giving us a metaphysical picture according to which space-time geometry comes after symmetries, we better have an independent handle on what we mean by symmetry group of the non-gravitational interactions in the theory of matter. Now, we've reviewed what the geometrical advocate thinks the symmetry group is, and that kind of way of thinking about it is not open to us, so we must have an alternative. So in this paper I've already mentioned, which I thoroughly recommend, David Wallace characterizes what he calls the coordinate-based approach. And this is, you know, perhaps the not not the most perspicuous quotation to give you, but the basic idea is that given, here's how you just present a theory. You present certain equations governing the field that it's a theory of in some coordinates, and you say that this is a field on a space with a certain structure. What structure? Well, it's the structure that's defined by a group of transformations. Which group of transformations? Just the group of transformations that is the symmetry group of the equations. So now we're taking the coordinate expression of the equations as basic. So in the geometrical approach, we had this kind of intrinsic characterization of the laws, expressed perhaps in terms of equations that could be written in the language of differential geometry. One doesn't need to do that, and it's important to separate the idea that we've got some intrinsic characterization of the laws from the right way to give that intrinsic characterization of the laws is differential geometric. But here what we're doing is saying, no, our basic way of presenting the theory takes equations presented with respect to a coordinate system as basic. Now, mathematically, this is perfectly legitimate, makes sense. You can consider in particular a space which is otherwise unstructured, except for the fact that I give you a bunch of preferred maps into Rn and that are related by a particular transformation group. And then I say, what are the structures I can define in ways using those coordinates which are invariant under the coordinate transformations that I've given you? However, if I just give you an equation and say it's with respect to a special coordinate system, it's not completely straightforward to work out what the other special coordinate systems are. And in particular, of course, it was a struggle over several decades to get to the fact, after Maxwell's equations were well known, that their symmetry group was the Lorentz group. And in particular, as has already been mentioned by Jill earlier, suppose I give you the laws of Newtonian gravity expressed in coordinate-dependent form, we've got this potential field, or maybe even a gravitational force field. And if we treat the potential field as a scalar, or perhaps something that's defined up to an additive term, or if we take the gravitational force field as a vector field, then the symmetry of these equations is the Galilean group. But if you think of those equations in a different way and think of this field not as one of those objects, but actually as the components of a connection in some special coordinates, then it turns out that the, or if you allow it to transform in a particular way, then your set of coordinates expands to the Maxwell group. Okay. And here's the basic point. It's not the basic point. But it is a point to make about this. If we're identifying structure via coordinates, we're ruling out our ability to discern interesting differences between that structure. So just take the Poincaré group plus, is that 5 minutes now? Okay, just take the Poincaré group plus scale transformations and ask, what is the structure that's invariant under those transformations? Well, we might say ratios of Minkowski distances. But actually, we could have said the non-qualitative two-place causal connectability relation. Because in terms of that, you can define everything else. Or you might take time-like straight lines and nothing else as basic. So the point is that there's an awful lot that might be invariant, but some subset of it might be sufficient for you to define the others. And there might be interesting metaphysical reasons for preferring one subset over the others, exactly as those who advocate some kind of causal theory of time, or as Tim Maudlin is recently doing, taking time-like structure of time-like lines as more fundamental, metaphysically. Now here's what I thought was the fundamental point. If you take this presentation of the theory seriously, and you think of laws in a non-Humean way, then I suggest this is a very unpleasant view. And it suffers from what Hartree Fields calls heavy-duty Platonism, because we're effectively saying, Here's what the world must be like. We've got some field, and it's constrained to evolve such that there's a map from it into the real numbers, such that under that description, certain equations are satisfied. So it looks like the real numbers are entering into the statement of the law in a way that's unpleasant. Now, a way of doing it without numbers is to say, I'll postulate some Minkowski structure, of course, but then we're back to the geometrical approach, and we're doing something like this. So this is a quote from Frank Arnzinius, but I've changed his example of rocks to chairs in deference to Michelle Esfeldt's talk yesterday. So suppose I were to claim that the world is pretty much as you think it is, except that chairs do not exist. So we've got the Humean pattern of, well, not the Humean pattern at this point, the pattern of people in the room that we want to explain. Now, the geometrical approach advocate says, well, there are these chairs, and people can sit on them, and there are various, you know, things they can do the dynamically possible dispositions of people are constrained by these real things, chairs. But no, on this approach, we're saying the true theory of the world merely says that things and properties and relations other than chairs are embeddable into a non-existing make-believe world that includes chairs. So this is the worry that David Albert was raising earlier. Okay, I just wanted to give you a quote of someone expressing this worry about this sort of approach. So how to make this more palatable? I've run out of time?
2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. Be a superhuman, as we've seen from several talks. It makes it a bit more palatable, but not very much more palatable. Okay, now here's Minkowski, and he can be considered to be advocating something like this. So here's how he describes what Lorentz covariance is. From the totality of natural phenomena, it's possible to derive a system of reference by means of which these phenomena then present themselves in agreement with definite laws. So we imagine we've got this kind of mosaic of the phenomena, not structured by the distance relations that the preferred coordinates define, but we kind of try out lots of different coordinates, and with respect to some, wow, we get a description that satisfies some nice equations. Of course, satisfying those equations doesn't fix the coordinates. If I've got one coordinate system that works, any coordinate system related to it by a Lorentz transformation will do the same job. So, here's the dynamical approach described in a Humean way in this kind of picture. So, the basic ontology is some field, some material fields, and we're imagining that they're spatiotemporal, but the spatiotemporal structure they have, maybe temporal is wrong, just kind of the extended spatial in a non-space versus time sense structure they have is topological, perhaps topological and differential. Then we consider only coordinate systems from that extended world that respect that structure and ask, is it the case that with respect to some proper subset of these, the description we get of the material world looks nice and simple in that it satisfies some maximally simple equations? And if the Humean mosaic of the differentially structured stuff is such that some nice simple equations that are Poincaré invariant are satisfied, then we've got a way of getting hold of the dynamical symmetries independently of postulated space-time symmetries. Okay. Dynamical geometry. So this is the last slide, and I'll quickly flick through it to leave it up as I'm out of time. We could pursue this view in general relativity. Here's how it might go. So we've got the same story about now special local coordinate systems. That only fixes those local coordinate systems up to Lorentz transformations. That allows us to define at each point a Minkowski metric, and now taken together they give us a Minkowski metric field, and then we look again at the pattern and see that that Minkowski metric field satisfies Einstein's field equations. But that's not the view that advocates of the dynamical approach take. They typically take the Minkowski metric as just another field, and if one does that, you end up saying things that I claim the advocate of the geometrical approach should agree with, pretty much. Okay, that's it. Thank you.